3, 2, 1.
Boom, and we are on. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of The Renegade Show. And today we're capping off season one with a very dear and special friend of mine. She has been with me and my family ever since we migrated here to Canada almost 11 years ago. And she's absolutely a tremendous human being, a compassionate person, and really an independent thinker herself. Without further ado, welcome Brandy to the pod.
Thank you so much, Kelvin, for having me on. And I don't know if I can live up to that introduction, but I'm sure I'm going to try.
Right. So Brandy, why don't you give the listeners a little bit biography of yourself, how you came to be Brandy?
Well, I mean, that story could be a long one, but I'll try to keep it short. But my mother was not a big drinker, but she did enjoy to have wine with meals, but she was not a big drinker. And one Christmas, about 10 years after she thought she'd had her last child, she had a couple of brandies. And well, I was the result about 9 months later, and I've been keeping them on their toes ever since. So it's been a lot of fun. But thankfully, they encouraged a lot of diversity of thought and lots of different questions and different veins of knowledge. And we had a very, I would say, liberal and open household. And so I got my good start there.
Yeah. And you're a lawyer by training. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm a lawyer by education and by training, and I did practice for really over about 30 years in Toronto, and then spent the last couple of years of my career in a full business role before retiring from corporate life and law and moving back to Halifax.
Yeah, and you came from one of the oldest, I think the most renowned, some would say, law school in the country.
Arguably so, yes, and definitely the oldest Dalhousie Law School, now known as the Schulich School of Law, over 200 years old.
And so, you know, when I met you, you had a very fascinating biography, and I was super enthralled at the fact that you not only had grew up in Canada, you spent some time in South America, so and you're well traveled as well since then. Tell us what brought you around the world, and what was the experiences? Because from what I can see, for most Canadians, they usually go to school, work, and then maybe take some vacations here and there. But you decided to really detour. Tell us about what led to that.
I do, and I'm still known to take detours now and then. But I love people. I love to meet new people. I love to see new places, hear different languages, eat different food. All of it, I think, with a drive to affirm what I've always believed, which is that all of us here on Earth have much more in common between us than we do differences. And I love traveling and meeting people and finding that is the case. And for the vast majority of time, that is what I find. But I like to follow my heart. I know that sounds trite, but I believe fully in heart and mind alignment. And one of the things that aligns for me is that travel and making sure that I see as much of the world as I possibly can. And part of that did take me south. I read a little book actually in 1989 called Coffee and Democracy. And it was a book about why Costa Rica developed so differently from all of its Central American neighbors and in the South America as well. And from that moment, I knew I had to go see the place and meet the people. And I absolutely fell in love with it. And so, yes, I ended up buying a farm there with my partner at the time, who later became my husband. And it was a fantastic experience. But yes, in 1989, 1992, when we bought, that was a bit of a renegade move. Absolutely.
What did your parents or your classmates who graduated, you thought of that move? Like you go ahead, you study to become a lawyer. I don't think that's a legal profession. And then you just decided to buy a farm. So what drove that? Like, and what did you see in the world that, you know, pushed you to do that? Right. And so early in your career as well.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, I have been very lucky. I got a terrific education. I was incredibly lucky to receive fantastic teachings and skill-based learning in my articles in the first couple of years of my career from top-notch people. But I knew within a couple of years that I never wanted to be a partner in a law firm, which was kind of the holy grail at that point. But I knew that that wasn't what I wanted. I found, as brilliant and wise and skilled and as incredible as these people were to watch, these mentors were to watch in the courtroom, if I asked the simple question, are you happy? They were unable to answer it. Mm. And that scared me. And I saw a lot of dysfunctional family relationships, which also scared me. And I just figured that I needed to take a different course. And Costa Rica and the farm and being in touch with the earth and all of my meditative practices, that was really the way to go. But I was never leaving law, not at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My kids know you as Sensei Brandy. So meditational practices and being a sensei, how did that take place? Because you actually made a surgeon to Japan to learn that. How
yes,
did you ended up being that Sensei Brandy?
Well, this is another series of wonderful sort of connections, and I'll call them coincidences, but I don't really believe in coincidences. But I started meditative practices when I was a small child, actually, in elementary school. And periodically, sort of every 6 to 10 years in my life, I run into, in a very random fashion, I meet a new person who offers me the chance to build on that. And so that happened to me in high school, and it happened in university, and it happened again in Costa Rica. And so over those years, I developed many, many practices of Qigong and Tai Chi and Bagua and various Eastern philosophies, until eventually I realized I had fallen fully into martial arts in the form of Meibukan Goju-Ryu Karate Do. And through my association with those individuals and fantastic learning there, I did have the chance to go to Japan a couple of times and to study at the Hombu Dojo, and many, many times had the benefit of learning from the grandmasters of the style. Again, I'm just incredibly, incredibly fortunate, and good luck to start, but I latch on to these things and I do work at them, so...
Yes. And it's interesting.
That was how I met, first of all, your girls, all of your girls, actually, your mm-hmm. daughters, and then also eventually your wife. And we all trained together. So.
Yeah. And you were the first female that I knew who was a black belt, and I should be worried about if I were to mess around with you. And I think there were different degrees of black belt, right? And what were you in the black belt degrees?
That's true. Well, so I had my dojo black belt rank, and mm. it's not necessary, right, to pursue all the different colored belt levels, but they are an indicator of progressions. But we have, ours is a very, very traditional style. And if you want to be a full instructor, you do have to have your dojo black belt mm. rank. And that means you have to learn to fight. And this was fascinating to me, absolutely fascinating, especially as a woman, because it's not something that we, generally not something that we are taught to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not comfortable. There are a lot of barriers, a lot of inner work you have to do to break through to be able to do that. And that was a great experience. But yes, so I have that. And that was in, I think, 2007. And then in 2009, I also received an international black belt rank as well in Meibukan.
Yeah. And in order to get that rank, you had to spar, you had to fight, correct?
Yes.
And how? And explain to me, how does a human being reconcile meditative practices and going into the ring and coming out with a belt? How does that occupy one human being, and let alone a female?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of different ways to approach my thoughts on answering that. One is they're not reconcilable, mm-hmm. and that's okay. That's okay. There's a lot of ambiguity in the world. You can't reconcile it at all. Learn to live with it is sort of often the approach that I'll take. And probably in the end, that is where I landed on that particular one, since you mentioned it. But But it's also all about really pushing your own envelopes and expanding your own skill set. And it is about trying to chart a course and a path that isn't necessarily the one that's well-traveled before you, although certainly there are many, many people went before me, but not so many women, is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I also, as a civil litigator, I found a lot of alignment again in my life and lots of things that I could relate it to. And so it didn't feel like such a big leap for me, right, to get there, because I'd already come out in the 80s and become a litigator in the late 80s and all through the 90s. So it didn't feel like that big of a jump.
Today, in today's world, you're seeing a lot of, I would say, backlash and really angst in the world. There was this whole Me Too movement that started last year. And then very recently, you're starting to see in the newspapers and in the media this idea of girl boss and very prominent women in heights of power are coming up and admitting that they were not being equitable in the hiring and nourishment of people of different races. And I want to understand from you as a woman, as a person who practiced meditation and as a fighter, what's happening in this world where there is this one part of the female community feels victimized, and then there's another part which is taking this girl boss to an extreme. What's your point of view on this?
Oh, that's a really big topic. I can tell you what I saw and what guided mm-hmm. me as I came along, especially over 30 years as a lawyer and having chosen litigation, which was sort of a maelstrom of masculinity, really, still mm-hmm. at the time in the late 80s. But I know in those first few years, there were so few female litigators who could be our role models. We didn't have a lot to go on. The ones that were there were quite fabulous. But as I moved along my career for the first few years and I saw other women around me, the ones who stayed and actually pursued a career mm-hmm. in it, I noticed that the way to move forward was often to mimic the behavior of men. And mm-hmm. so what I saw a lot of times were really women behaving like men, and I did not want to, I didn't want to turn out that way, basically. And so I was quite determined from early on to not let those kinds of behaviors creep in or that sort of language, or again, sounds trite, but I was talking about civility, long civility in the profession many years before the Law Society struck a committee to study it. And I really did and do believe that it's important. Mm-hmm. So again, it's just that independent streak, that independence of mind. But I also think I come back to heart-mind alignment a lot. I knew by then that money was never going to be my primary goal. It was never a primary motivator for me. I always felt lucky. I was able to earn enough money to enjoy my life and raise my son, my family and whatnot. But it was never a primary motivator. There were always other things. So that, and again, I wasn't striving to be a partner in a law firm. I had relieved myself of all of those more typical burdens, if you will.
Yeah. And, you know, at the height of your career, you decided to take another detour and followed your passion into traditional Eastern, philosophy. But before we jump into that, I remember a very vivid conversation about the city where you and I used to live in, and you decided to go back to your hometown. And this statement kept ringing in my ear. The emperor has no clothes, Kelvin. The emperor has no clothes. And then, a couple of months later, here you're uprooting yourself from the city. You pretty much had your major professional career, and you went back literally east to practice an Eastern philosophy. Tell me what drove that. What you meant by the emperor has no clothes, and where are you now in this new career of yours?
Well, I do remember that conversation when you talk about it. One of many good ones we had, and I hope we get to do that again sometime. I I found through, I loved the practice of law. I appreciated everything that was given to me in coming up in that field. But eventually I found that it was a bit lonely. I preferred to be part of a team. I like functioning as part of a team. I like having shared responsibilities with other people. I'm capable of sort of directing the show on my own, but I prefer to be in a team. So I had actually moved to working within large organizations, mm-hmm. a couple of quite large organizations. And again, I appreciated a lot of what they allowed me to learn and to explore, and a whole new skill sets and management skills and whatnot. And that was great. But what I found when I was turning to look for leadership from someone else to me, the emperor had no clothes. And it wasn't just that it happened once or in one organization. It was that I saw it time after time after time. Mm-hmm. And eventually I just, that phrase came out in our conversation that time, but the emperor has no clothes, meaning what I'm looking for in terms of the leadership that I crave to have from someone else just doesn't seem to be out there. Yeah. And I'm aging. I'm almost 56, and I had to think about very seriously about where I was going to direct my remaining time and energy, right? Mm-hmm. And so I decided to move back to my hometown, Halifax, and I am studying traditional Chinese medicine acupuncture.
And became a student all over again.
I'm a student again. It's fantastic.
And now that you're in your in university and you're learning Chinese medicine, you're going to come out in a very different world with COVID and the pandemic and social distancing. Any regrets about going into a profession where you actually have to be physical and there's proximity? Any doubts, any worries about the world you're going to graduate into?
No, none at all. In fact, I'm happier than ever that I made the change. And specifically, working with my hands, actually through my hands, was a big part of the changes that I decided to make in my life, because for the first few decades, career-wise anyway, I had been functioning very much through brain power. And that's fine. But I've always loved to use my hands and to be connected through my hands. So I'm really looking forward to this. And as far as the pandemic and difficulties that exist in so many places, I think that the Chinese medicine is just such a fantastic balance. And mm-hmm. it's individual based. So you don't have to be part of a system to be able to apply this or to make it work for you. It's very, very customized. It's very individual based. And I actually hope to travel with it to places and regions and people who are struck by various humanitarian crises or disasters and be able to give that sort of relief. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. I had a good fortune of meeting your dad, probably one of the first war veteran that I've ever met in North America coming to this country. And the relationship you've had with him and the relationship you have with your son is one of really fondness and respect. What did your dad teach you about relationships that you then took in raising your son? Because I found that really interesting, because that's not usually the way parents and interact with their children. And I found it very fascinating in the sense that there was this independence, very strong empowerment, and yet there is this vulnerability between you and him and your son and you. How did that relationship translate to how you raised your son? I'm interested in that.
Wow. Well, we're really going deep now, but I think you really hit it. There's a very, very deep bond between the three of us, actually. Mm-hmm. But especially my father and I had a very strong bond. Mm-hmm. And as he just passed in December, so I'm still getting used to that, but just a very deep respect for each other. And he never consciously tried to get me to do what he wanted. He never tried to change my mind if I said I wanted to study law or changed my mind when I wanted to be a dancer. He always supported wherever I was at the time. Hey, Dad, I'm buying a farm in Costa Rica, and he was fully in support of me. You know, Dad, I'm converting to Judaism, and I'm going to have a big Jewish wedding. He was right there with a yarmulke on. I mean, I don't think he ever really let me down. And part of it might be because we didn't put, you know, we didn't impose too great an expectation on each other, but we each always knew that the other was there and still do. And it's absolutely the same thing for my son. I took all of that, I guess, consciously and unconsciously, and put that into how I raised my son, who is just fantastic.
I think whatever I've learned about raising my two girls, I've learned watching that relationship between your dad and you, and how you raised your son Sam. I find that parents want to control and want to dictate how the children should be. But what I learned from you between the relationship that I saw between you and your dad and you and your son was, you could have fierce empowerment, and yet they know they can be vulnerable with you. And that, I think that's just a beautiful thing.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you touched on that. I wasn't expecting it, but I'm really glad you did. I'm very fortunate.
Yeah, and when I look at the friends and the people that you keep, that your social circles, they're a really diverse mix of people. You've got everybody in the rainbow, right? You've got someone who upcycles very interesting pieces of art and work in helping the environment. You've got several folks who are in arts and music. I think you yourself is the patron of the arts. I think you sponsor an artist or some folks. Tell me, where does this love of art and culture and architecture come from?
I have always loved the arts and artists and supporting the arts. I believe fervently in maintaining the arts within a community, and that we can't have healthy, vibrant, strong communities without artists and art in our midst. So yeah, I support it as much as I can. I support the creative endeavor, and I don't think that most of us aren't objectively fantastic artists, but I think that we should all be involved in creative endeavors just because it's a good and valuable part of life. And I support that in my son. I support it in all my friends. I'm so lucky to have so many friends that are involved. But I would say, and I include you in this, there are some strong themes that run through all of my friends, whether from every walk of life, and that is social conscience and social justice. And that's always been there. Even before I knew social justice as a phrase, it was always there. So, and I think that's part of my very strong central core. Mm-hmm. And again, that comes from my family and my upbringing. I'm very lucky.
And not only are you interested in arts, you're an artist yourself. So tell me about this idea of working with your hands and painting, because I've seen some of your work, and will we be able to see it in a, you know, I've been always trying to coax you to do a show one day. Where did that come from?
I think my mother put a paintbrush in my hand by the time I was three. Mm-hmm. And she painted, and I love to write. Now and then I write, but I've also had a lot of automatic writing in my life, if I can call it that. I don't know whether listeners will understand what that is, but it goes along with sort of my earliest phases of meditation and energetic understandings of human beings. So mm-hmm. I still write, I'm happy to say. I call it poetry. I don't know if it technically is poetry, but sometimes it's prose. But there's a lot of poetry. But these days, I'll use anything but a paintbrush when it comes to sitting down with a canvas or construction paper or anything else. And I'll use almost any kind of tool. Chopsticks these days are one of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. And bring all of it. Mixing media in all the most inappropriate ways, you know, according to proper art teachers, and loving it.
Yeah. And when we talk about social justice today, back in our own country, we see the plight of the indigenous people. We see posters around town about how they still feel that they haven't been given a fair shake. And I think you have some heritage coming from there as well. What's your perspective around the justice that the indigenous people have gotten, just broadly, not just here, but just around the world?
So you're right. I do have First Nations heritage, both Algonquin and Mohawk. Mm-hmm. I grew up knowing my Mohawk roots, but my Algonquin heritage has only recently come to me in the last sort of 15 years, I would say, when they were looking for me, the tribe was looking for me as a descendant of a known Algonquin man. But yeah, I think this is, I don't know why, but this is an area, I'll say in Canada for sure, where I really think we have lagged behind. And the principles are known. We had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We have all kinds of well-evidenced knowledge and information. We know the history of what has happened. We know where we need to go. We know reparations need to be made. But for some reason, for some unbelievable, unknown reason, we can't get clean drinking water into certain First Nations communities. And that's just mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me that we still have that here in Canada. And having just had Canada Day, of course, our home on their native land is definitely close to heart these days.
What needs to happen for these things to change? Is it more involvement from the civic community? Is it awareness? Is it just the will to do something as basic as providing clean water to these folks? Like, what needs to change in your opinion?
I think there's that. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that in Canada who wouldn't agree that getting clean drinking water to every community within Canada is the right thing to do. But I think it's a matter of awareness in the sense that you can talk about things or issues or stances, but until you really start to learn how to live it and feel it, you're not motivated to make a change. So once people start, like right now, we're all having a moment where if you were in any doubt as a white person in Canada or in North America as to whether or not you had white privilege, or if you didn't understand what that meant, you probably do today compared to 4 months ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think something similar to that is what needs to take place, but from the perspective of, you know, being from a long line of descendants that visit this country and this place, right? Mm. Which was inhabited by others before. Yeah. And I really think it's as simple as understanding that we all inhabit and we all share the limited space that exists on the planet. So,
yeah. So as we wrap up this episode, there are a lot of young women, young girls, and even women who are at the height of their career, thinking about taking a different path in life. And you, through the way your mom brought you up, the love of your dad, the detours you've taken in your life, did you feel that you would have had a better life had you not taken the detour? Or did you feel that you could raise your child, have a good life, and now enjoy the next set of career because you took those detours? What's your advice to these folks listening?
No, I absolutely feel better for having taken those detours, because that is when I come back again to this idea of heart and mind alignment. Do the inner work. It's tough, it's trying, but it's worthwhile. And once your heart and mind are in alignment, you'll always know what your true north is. And if you follow that, I honestly believe you can't go wrong if you follow that. And it following that doesn't mean you'll necessarily be richer or poorer or smarter or not. It's not about those things. It's about whether it is what suits for you, right?
Yeah.
And sort of avoiding sifting. I call it inner work, but it's really kind of a sifting process through everything that's sloshing around inside and getting through to what keeps your home fires burning, what keeps the hearth, right, going, what keeps your creativity going, what keeps your center of reference, your central core, all of those things. But I always had a saying through it all. I'd say, say what you do, do what you say, and check every now and then and see if it's still true. And I can't remember where I got that from, but it really stuck with me. And so I would always say, mind the gap, Brandy. I would tell myself, right? As soon as I would see a gap in those things, I would know that it was time to sit down and reassess whatever that issue was. And see whether I need to make changes, or whether if I'm suffering cognitive dissonance, if I'm thinking and saying one thing, but I'm actually doing the opposite, like I need to sit down and sort through that. And every time I did, every detour I've made, I haven't done it unthinkingly. And I never put sort of the health or the place of my son at any kind of risk for it. I wouldn't do that. But I've followed them. I've followed them so far, and I plan to keep doing it.
And what's your wish for all the renegades listening out there?
Keep that core of that streak of independence and independent critical thought, and that streak of freedom, that ever freedom-loving independence alive.
Thank you for coming on the pod. Thank you for being the role model for my two daughters. And thank you for closing off season one for us, Brandy.
Well, thank you, Kelvin. And thank you for all your years of friendship. I look forward to seeing you and the family again, I hope soon. And I hope your listeners enjoy some of this.
Yeah. Till we meet the rest of you in season two, this is Kelvin and Brandy signing off for the Renegade Show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.